So, breathing in. Breathing out. So now you can close your eyes or lower your gaze or turn away from your screen. You want to connect with your body. You know, when we close our eyes, that change in perception can kind of evoke different responses, but we really want to make sure that we direct the attention into the body right away, because that really helps us to arrive and be grounded. Yeah, there might be a tendency when you close your eyes to immediately go off into the mind, the images or thoughts or fantasies or memories. So grounding ourselves in the body, one way to do that is to sort of move the attention through the body. So you're not just kind of randomly trying to feel your body, but really be specific, feel your face. There's something to feel, the skin, the muscles in the jaw, the eyes. Just relaxing, releasing. The shoulders, let them settle. And the arms and hands. The hands are very sensitive. Often the place where we contact the world, we touch the world. So much of our relationship to objects is through the hands. And yet we don't really notice how they feel unless something extreme like heat or cold or pressure comes and we react to that. So just feel what your hands feel like right now. The thing about feeling the body is that it's not a static thing. So that can be confusing in a way. It's like, what am I supposed to be feeling? It's not just a solid sensation, it's dynamic and changing. You might feel pulsing or tingling. Pressure, or lightness, density, cool, warm. You might feel several of these sensations at once. And then connecting with the breath. The breath is another sensation that's very dynamic. Out the rhythm, flow of sensations. When you hear the suggestion to be mindful of the breath, where does your attention go? Do you think of the breath as in the lungs or the nose or the mouth, the chest or the belly? You can actually be mindful of the breath at any one of these points, or perhaps the throat, back of the throat. The point isn't that there's some correct way or correct place to be mindful. It's just to find a connection with the breath. Feels somewhat natural, comfortable. We say rest the awareness on one point of sensation or one area of sensation. What this suggests is that, well, the breath, body, and all these objects of perception are changing. That awareness itself is not like that. Awareness doesn't have that quality of change in it. So we try to connect with just the purity of awareness, resting in awareness. Much of the time, though, we'll find it challenging to let the awareness rest. Instead, the mind departs. So with great patience, with the real sense of kindness towards ourselves, we just guide the attention back each time we realize it's wandered. You know, it's beautiful when we can find that place of rest. It's very revealing and opens our minds. But that's not always possible. So one of the challenges of practice is to find the value in sitting through distraction, agitation, restlessness, or dullness. That can teach us not to strive so much, to be accepting whatever arises. And then perhaps something else will be revealed within the distraction, within the agitation. right. So again, welcome. The other thing to continue the discussion of March, of course, the distinctive thing for us all now is that this is when it all began, more or less, in our awareness. Anyway, that the last time that I taught live was at the last weekend of February of 2020. And that was a weekend that I taught it for Inside LA. In LA, what a concept. And, you know, it's like you have to say that. I was teaching for Inside LA in LA. Oh, wow, that's wild. How'd you do that? But I do remember that there was awareness enough that I very clearly was not shaking people's hands. You know, I was, there was the dawning awareness that Houston, we have a problem, as we say. So yeah, so this month will be marking a year also of these Zoom classes that I started on March 13th. And over that time, we've been working with my book, One Breath at a Time. And we've gotten to step 7. I spent a few classes, a couple of classes talking about God, particularly through the lens of the teachings of Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, a Thai forest monk. I actually put those videos up yesterday for anybody who missed them and wants to see them on YouTube, on my YouTube channel. I've now got almost 70 videos from this past year up there. And before that, I think I had 3 videos up. So it's been good for my YouTube presence. So we're in step 7. And I'll say again that, you know, my understanding of step 7 is very different from the literal language of the 12 steps, which say we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, him with a capital H referring to God. And for me, it's much more about just the idea of letting go. And what are we letting go of? In Buddhist terms, the causes of suffering, you know. So you can call those shortcomings, but really, you know, the Buddha doesn't really personalize these things in a way. I mean, yeah, there's personal elements to them, but the larger point is that we're just looking at what's causing suffering moment by moment and trying to let go of that. And yes, some of that is for us as individuals is historic, and certainly as addicts, you know, historically, it was our addiction that caused us suffering. So we're trying to let go of that. But hopefully by the time you get to step 7, you've let go of the activity, and then you're really, what you're talking about is the underlying causes and tendencies and habits. And so what the steps call your character defects and shortcomings and all that. One of the things that, that I addressed in One Breath at a Time, well, this section is called Who Am I? So really this question of identity, which is, you know, very much tied in with the causes of suffering. You know, in Buddhist terms, it's kind of the essence of what causes suffering is our identification with self, or just with, you know, clinging to identity, we could say. All of that can get sort of abstract. So, you know, certainly one of my approaches to writing this book was to, you know, embody and personalize the abstractions so that that they would be relatable. And of course, part of that was based in the idea of bringing the 12-step tradition or 12-step sort of orientation of storytelling into an exploration of Dharma. And so a lot of the stories are about me. Easiest ones for me to dredge up. And so this section has a bunch about my own process. And I'm not particularly too interested in talking about those elements of the story. I think that they're readable, but, you're welcome to read them. But maybe some of the more general ideas. And so there was, there are a couple ideas that opened the section. In this one line, I particularly like: getting clean and sober can, quote, can shatter our self-image and allow for radical change. I think that's a really interesting idea, because there's such a, the kind of common idea about particularly admitting you're an alcoholic or an addict, rather than just sort of saying, oh, I'm going to stop drinking, but sort of is that it's an identity that you, a label people don't want to take on. And I was just listening to the podcast, the 10% Happier podcast after mine, where I felt like maybe they were trolling me a little bit by maybe taking it too personally, but bringing on a woman who's like, the 12 steps are blah, 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 and the usual stories that I get tired of hearing about people's, what's wrong with the 12 steps. Or she has this whole thing about like, if you go to AA, you have to, I'm sorry, I shouldn't be doing this, but anyway, you have to enter the door, you have to say that you're an alcoholic. And I just wanted to I've considered, but I probably won't, like writing to them and saying, that's really misinformation. You don't have to say you're an alcoholic if you go to Alcoholics Anonymous. The requirement for membership, only requirement, is the desire to stop drinking. And I've heard lots of people identify themselves in other ways. Nonetheless, yes, it is a cultural thing to say it. But the thing is, people miss the point of that. It's not taking on a label. It's letting go of a problem. It's understanding that I can't drink. I have proved that for myself. I have repeatedly tested the proposition that I could drink, that I could control it, that I could not have a problem with it. Over years, I tested that proposition and proved to my satisfaction that it doesn't work. I need to stop drinking. How can I do that? Well, one of the ways is to recreate your identity, right? Because your identity is a drinker. It's interesting. This woman says something that I always thought during my drinking days too, that like people that don't drink are just like weird, right? Like it's like, who would want to hang out with those people? Like they're sort of some kind of religious fanatics or something. And so it's realizing like, oh, like there's another identity. And it, this, I don't know, it doesn't have to be alcoholic, but that label to me just kind of creates this nice red line that I know I can't cross. It's like that, and it, end of conversation, because believe me, I want to have that conversation and argue about it, and did argue about it, for a long time. And once the argument is over, because it's like, oh, that's solved. I'm an alcoholic. I don't drink. Fine. I don't care. The interesting thing, though, is that, people, and of course, I didn't want to label myself an alcoholic until I did. But, that people, there's this thing of stigma and shame. And I guess I had that. It's so long ago that I don't know that I remember. But does our culture really stigmatize alcoholism that much these days? You guys probably know better than I. It just doesn't, it seems to me like it's sort of like if you tell somebody, oh, I'm an alcoholic, I'm a sober alcoholic, usually what people say is, oh, that's great. They don't say, ew, that's disgusting. They're like, people tend to be supportive. I don't know where, so I think what we're really talking about is the internal shame, right? And the internal stigma. That's what people struggle with. Okay, I understand that. Anyway, I think I'm having an argument with myself, which is probably not very productive. What I want to get at, though, is the ways that our self-identification, our the way we define ourselves, limits us. And for me, that was not just that I'm somebody who drinks and gets high all the time, but it was all tied up with my career of being a musician and somehow being like a rebel or an outsider, whatever it was. And getting sober, as I say here, shattered my self-image and allowed for radical change, because it was like, oh, if this sort of foundational idea about myself that I'm somebody who drinks and uses and that that's kind of cool or whatever is thrown out the window, the realization that, oh, what about the other stuff? I wonder if some of the other stuff I believe isn't really helpful too, And because I literally thought, like, people that got up, I talked about this recently, people that got up in the morning and went to work were losers and suckers. Like, because I'm there, like, if I saw anybody getting up to work, to go to work in the morning, it was because I'd been up all night, right? And to me, that was a great lifestyle. That was freedom. And to try like changing that, going, oh, what if I got a job? And then gradually, eventually I got this like sort of normal-ish job, because I had had jobs, but they were like, work in a health food store. What else did I do? Well, when I was young, I worked in factories. But, I never had like sort of something where you worked in an office and you'd like put on a nice shirt and they gave you benefits and holidays and stuff like that. I was like, what? And then I got that. I was like, oh, this is pretty cool. Oh, wow, I can go to the dentist. It's been a while, I get paid to not work today. That's pretty amazing. And also I get paid at the end of the week. Like when you're a musician, you don't always get paid. If the bar owner decides you didn't have a good week. So it was just like opening up these possibilities of being somebody different. I use my own life and stories for these things, and I don't know, for these sort of examples, and I don't know that they apply for every person, but I'll say like the story for me about I'm a musician and that's who I am had this caveat in it. It had this, that's not quite a caveat, just this element of it, which was, I can't do anything else. And that was the real failing of that belief. The belief that, I dropped out of high school, but that's kind of cool because I'm a dropout, it was the 60s, and I'm a musician and that's cool. So what if I'm poor and, there's no security in my life. But behind it all was like, actually, I don't have any choice. You know, that was the bad part of it. It's like, I didn't believe I had any choices. And that is a famous phrase you hear in meetings, which is, we have choices today. So talking about freedom, you know, as I say, you know, I thought of myself as being very free because I'm a musician and I can, you know, I can drink and use at work. It's part of my job. But then realizing that it wasn't freedom. So thinking about that reminded me of Bhikkhu Bodhi's essay, which I've gone back to a couple times over this past year, called The Taste of Freedom, where he talks about, contrasts what he calls freedom as license and freedom versus freedom as spiritual autonomy. And in our country, in the United States of America, not always so united, but anyway, you know, our sense of freedom is all about license, the right to do things, you know, and some of which are actually not very helpful for the rest of the population, like carrying guns. But Bhikkhu Bodhi is like, that kind of freedom is only external and is always limited because you still are enslaved, not the, okay, yeah, I don't know if that's a fair term, because it's such a triggering term. We're still trapped in our own minds, in our own greed, hatred, and delusion. And no matter how free you are, which, again, you know, the other thing about freedom in our country is it's associated with money. If you have a lot of money, then you're free. And in fact, you know, it can get you out of trouble, you know, legal trouble, but you're free to, you know, travel and to, you know, do things that you want to do. But Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, points out that, well, yeah, you can have all that stuff, but if you're angry or you're depressed or you're feeling greedy, you know, then there's no real freedom. You're still trapped in your own mind. And so that was very much my realization, that I thought of my lifestyle as making me free. And when I took on a less obviously free lifestyle, a 9-to-5 job, that I felt more free inside, because I'd been really trapped by a sense. The trap was the belief that I couldn't, that I had to do this one thing and that I couldn't do anything else. And then doing something else, which was just like a random office job in a school district, was like, oh, I can do all kinds of stuff. You know, this is interesting. Like, it's wild, you know. How strange. I see people have been a couple of little comments here, so maybe I'll look over at them and we can talk a little bit. There is one more note I want to refer to here, that even positive identities can become a trap. So, you know, trapped in being, I'm a Dharma teacher, you know. Isn't that wonderful? But if people find out who I really am, or, you know, just in our familial relationships, being a parent or being a child, or, you know, all the ways that that we identify ourselves, being a success. You know, what happens when you fail? When you're a parent, what happens when your child dies? If you're married, what happens when you get divorced? You know, who are you? Monica says she had the reverse problem. After I got sober, I was terrified to go back to music. in art because getting loaded with so much. Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense. Yeah. I just think on a whole other sort of topic, but that art and creativity are so healing. It's so important. Someone was writing to me about being depressed because I mentioned that on 10% Happier, and she's like, thank you so much for saying that. I've been struggling. And I sort of like wrote out the list of things that like are the healthy antidepressant activities. And I always come to, oh, right, an art, being creative. Yeah, but not tying up your identity with it. Yeah. And Christine says, I'm describing her father. Well, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. Anyway, thank you.
It's Angela.
Yes.
There was also, I was trying to remember, there was a question about when you first started teaching about repeating. I don't know if you read the first line from the section.
Oh, no. Oh, can I repeat the quote? Oh, yeah. It can shatter our self-image and allow for radical change.
And what is that from?
That's from a book called One Breath at a Time, Buddhism and the 12 Steps. From the section called Who Am I?
Oh, okay. I see it here in the first paragraph.
That's the first paragraph. That's
recognizing. Okay.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Oh, is that what this is?
What?
One Breath at a Time?
Yeah. Anybody want to toss anything in verbally? Oh, people are chatting today. Okay. Oh, that's interesting. Oh, he has freedom due to wealth. Oh. Yeah, right. Well, tell him to give it away. You can come here and,
I tried.
Give some Donna.
Yep.
Yeah, that's painful. It's painful. I mean, that's the kind of Donald Trump, sorry to bring him up, but, somebody who's horribly miserable who spends all his time, thinking he's free. An entire psychic change in the big book. Right. Thanks, Vicky. Good point. Yeah, psychic change. Yeah, Julie.
Hi. Hello, everybody. I'm so happy to be here. Regarding identification, first of all, I had written down from the other day what you said, which I just absolutely love. In step 7, a way to reframe that is to let go of that which causes suffering. And, you said today, one of the core sufferings is clinging to one's self-identity. And that just really resonates with me. I can't, the 12 steps are problematic for me until you unite it with the way you approach Buddhist practice. So I'm always so grateful for the light you shine. I was listening to a talk the other day, and this really resonated with me too, so I'll share it. When we think about changing something, we often think in terms of our behavior and action and habit to make these tiny baby steps toward changes in behavior. Mm-hmm. But if we don't change our self-concept, if I say, and I have for a long time, I just can't let go. I can't surrender. I can't do that. Part of who I am is I am a person who will never be able to surrender sufficient enough to recover from my addictions. So I can change, I can try to change all the behaviors in the world, but if I don't change that self-concept, I can't really contain for myself. This is true for me. I'm always going to be stuck with that limiting belief that it's not really going to happen for me. And I think self-concepts, you know, for me can change. They're not solid any more than anything else is solid, but they need to be my self-concept, my identification, if you will, need to be far more expansive to in terms of letting go what isn't beneficial and wholesome and embracing not just new behaviors, but the concept that says, I can do this. Yeah. I can surrender. So it's that self identity. And of course, labels, you know, like fire, they can be useful. They can be harmful.
Right.
I love your approach to step 7 and 1 through 6 and 8 through 12, by the way. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. That, I do think that one of the ways people get stuck in recovery is when they just work on the external. And that's sort of the whole, I guess, in some great extent, the what my work is about and why I'm not really oriented towards getting people sober or getting them clean or getting them into recovery. That I don't offer a program like, here's how to get started, but rather, here's how to keep it going. That's kind of what I'm more trying to get at, because that's where I see so many people get stuck. And as you say, like, if you change the externals, great, you know, you're not getting drunk, you know, you're not having these external problems in your life. But if you're still carrying around these internal wounds and internal identity, negative identity, or even just unhelpful identities, then you know, you wind up kind of a dry drunk, I guess, something like that. So somebody's asking about the 7-step prayer and how, any suggestions for a more letting go approach. I have to admit that I kind of never connected with the AA prayers, the 3rd step prayer and the 7th step prayer. It's something about, does somebody want to maybe, who wrote that? Sorry, Stanley, do you want to recite the 7th step prayer and then I can fix it for you? It's like, God, take all of me now or something. I am ready for you to take anybody.
My creator.
Okay.
I am willing that you should have all of me.
You know, in terms of, I mean, it's interesting that Buddhadasa says the creator is ignorance. That's a very Buddhist approach. He said, because everything starts out of the misunderstanding. We create identity, we create ego, we create suffering out of not understanding that suffering arises out of clinging. And so which is totally crazy in terms of, like, so that doesn't help, right? But anyway, my creator, I am now ready. Keep going, Angela.
Willing. You have all of me, good and bad.
Yeah.
I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding.
Yeah. Well, it seems like a good idea. You know, it's just, I think it's to me, it's really about shifting orientation about it being me and God. It's that relationship that's problematic for me. I don't know if that's what's problematic for Stanley. I mean, that's the starting point that's problematic. It's like, I'm going to ask some external being or force to intervene and fix things for me or control me or change me. And So if I can see it as, we use in the metta phrases, the loving kindness phrases, we say, may I be happy. So, I mean, may you be happy. I could just put it in those kind of terms, like, may, and then think about this, you know, that suffering is created by clinging to identity. And so what is it? Give me some of the phrases again. Like, what is it that I want to?
Have all of me, good and bad.
Right.
And then remove from me every single defect of character, which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my
somebody else can help here, but I'm trying to figure out, like, what's God supposed to do? I'm giving everything to God, and then he's going to, like, fix it up and then take out the bad stuff. It's something like that seems to be. So I guess I'm sort of missing the point of it, but I mean, I guess I would just try to make it simpler that I'm trying to let go of the destructive qualities that I have. And how am I going to do that? First, I have to start with awareness to see what they are. Then I have to make an intention to not think, speak, or act on those negative impulses and negative habitual behavior, internal and external behaviors. And then I trust that through that, you know, as Buddhadasa says, through the, beseeching the law of karma, that is, through my actions, through changing the way I think, speak, and act, that I will become a different person, that my life will unfold differently. And of course, I do really appreciate that, because this is just like the 11th step that is saying the end point that we're trying to get to is a place of being of service. We're not trying to do this in order, that's definitely one of the things that I think is helpful about the way the steps are oriented, which is do all this stuff, but it's not about perfecting yourself and creating this perfect life for yourself. It's about becoming someone who can be of service in the world, or somebody who can be a contributing member of society, not someone who's like, well, now I'm really great. I don't have any shortcomings. I'm such a good person. Vicky, what have you got?
Okay, so I didn't know that prayer by heart. And I've recently copied it down. And the things I've underlined are now willing, like now. So that there's a kind of presence there, and then the strength, and then also from here. So there's a moment there, this is like presence, I think, it's talking about being present.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of like, because I had a real reaction to it too. And now I'm getting friendlier with it. So anyway.
Cool. Thanks, Vicky. That's great. Christopher, hi. Hey, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much, man. First, I just wanted to say, brother, thank you so much for being here. I'm so grateful that I heard you on, I sent you an email too.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. I heard you on the 10% Happier app, and mm-hmm. I was really excited to check this out. And all the other beautiful people here, thank you all so much for being here. This was like, maybe the first hour of my sobriety so far that I really felt connected, maybe since I started in sobriety, which was about 14 years ago.
Wow.
Man, you, first of all, you 100% told my story as well. I appreciate that.
Right. I know you're a musician, right?
I'm also a musician, but also just the self-identification stuff.
Yeah.
Also a high school dropout. I have a very clear vision in my brain of what I am, in big capital letter quoted letters.
Yeah.
And just the fact that I sort of walked in here on the seventh step talk discussion day is crazy. I mean, it's just perfectly, I think this to me personally is perfectly suited to Buddhist philosophy in that, like, I mean, my experience with the seventh step, first time I did the steps, was about 14 years ago. And, I remember very clearly, the sponsor I had at the time, I had 14 years in AA. So it was an AA sponsor I had at the time. We did the sixth step, put all these shortcomings down, character defects or problematic, personality traits, as if you want to say, down on paper. And then we're like going to do the seventh step, which is where you give it all away, like we're talking about. But he had to go. He's like, I got to take off, you know? So let's reconvene in a couple of weeks. And I always say that it was the most perfect serendipitous, or I don't know, serendipitous is a good word for it, thing, because it left me alone with my own, you know, challenging personality traits for like 2 weeks, very raw and very clear in my mind. I am an irritable person. I have problems with impatience. I'm just angry and, cruel sometimes, you know, some of these things that are in all of us, but
well, because speak for yourself, come on, man, like,
but because I was left alone with them, I was able to see how they worked in my daily life.
Yeah.
For a good few weeks, as more clearly than I had ever seen before. And this is what perfectly translates to Buddhism for me. You know, I'm immediately reminded of like Thich Nhat Hanh when I read a lot of Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, ideas about this kind of stuff. He talks about watering the seeds, and we all have these seeds in us. It's just part of the human condition. It's part of what being alive, at least as a human, is about. And when we recognize, like, you know, whether it's giving it away to a specific idea of God or opening up enough, like also like Pema Chodron talks about, to start seeing where these pieces of armor were. I got really afraid at first about like addressing my impatience, for example, or some of these things I thought were like protecting me since I was a kid. You know, this like anger, I was like, this is part of who I am. This is how I have survived in the world. How am I supposed to just like take this armor off? But as I started to, it thawed me, it melted me a little bit and warmed me from the inside. And I started to see that I can not only function and be, you know, survive in the world, but like you were talking about, I can find more ways to be useful from a more vulnerable, honest now place.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Beautiful.
That's kind of what I was getting from you too, about just the idea of, being here and being aware of how this applies to like, who am I? You know, my identification with being an impatient person or being, and like, I think it was Julie who said, like, these became parts of who I thought I was, or this identity that I had built up. And it's like, so important to recognize, like, impatience is in me, but I'm not an impatient person.
Right.
And we can water those seeds, you know, that kind of counteract some of those things and try to not consciously water the seeds of impatience as much, but just kind of do our best to take some of this armor off so that we can be available in a more honest and open way. Dude, this blew my mind today, man. I am seriously so grateful to be here and to have heard you and to hear everybody else who's shared about this today. It's such an awesome way to look at the bridge between, I think, more true open spirituality and a program like recovery. So thank you.
Very nice. Thank you, Christopher. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, you too.
So, Jim, nice to see you, Jim. And yeah, well, because we're running over, but who cares? if you have somewhere to go, you know.
Thanks, Kevin. Welcome, Christopher. Glad you found this group. I think like the feeling, the sense of belonging is so important to recovery, fitting in, finding that place. You know, I just think that people get, you know, it's that thing with higher power, God, where we're looking for what we don't agree with. And so
right.
It's a person, it's this guy in the sky with a beard, you know, and I'm not going to surrender to that. And, you know, what if just, you know, the seventh step is about surrendering to the process of recovery. Yeah. And just working the rest of the steps. And as you said, being of service, you know, ultimately it's about being of service and practicing these principles in all our affairs. And I think the problem with the sixth and seventh step is we can get so self-involved in fixing ourselves and, you know, trying to change our character defects. And we lose the bigger picture of what recovery is about. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, it's not about being a perfect person. Yeah. It's about doing the best we can. You know, what do they say? The next right action.
Yeah.
Like that's all we can really do. And so I think just letting go of that God as being a guy or a person or a personality and just thinking about it as this process that we're all in together.
Yeah. Yep. Well put. Thank you, Jim. So, maybe just a moment to be grateful for each other and for our recovery. You know, I had a pretty interesting retreat last week. And as I often do after a retreat, I kind of feel this reinvigorated commitment to just this simple practice. You know, it just seems like there's so many things that are so important. And then when I practice for a few days, so many of them fall away. And so I'm doing more sitting and more effort to just be present as I move through my day and my life. So I hope that I can encourage you all to do that, to keep up your daily sitting and draw on. There's so many resources now, but you know, the main one is in here. So keep turning inward, bringing kindness to yourself. So, blessings.